This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Healing Process. This is lecture 3 entitled Diagnosis, Treatment, and the Production of Remedies Based on Spiritual Science. Lecture 2 of two parts, given in London on September 3rd, 1923. I have been told that you would like a more extensive theoretical rationale for the ideas that I presented yesterday. It always seems to me that the doubt and inner opposition that anthroposophical views understandably encounter are strengthened when this spiritual rationale is supplied. Especially with regard to medicine, I have some hope that if our remedies prove helpful in practice, people will see that there must be some validity to their theoretical underpinnings. In this particular field, therefore, I am somewhat reluctant to present the theoretical background unless it is explicitly requested. Although the theory is as precise as mathematics, I am sure it initially sounds even more fantastical than any account of how our remedies are used in practice. Since you have requested it, however, I will begin today's lecture with more information on the theoretical background, rather than leaving it for the end, as I had planned. My main point is that although the admirable progress of modern science has accomplished wonders for our knowledge of the outer, physical, sense-perceptible world, this same knowledge has prevented us from grasping the full implications of being human. If we apply natural laws derived from the outer world, through either observation or experimentation, to the human being, they are sufficient for understanding the organization of the human senses, that is, the sense organs that are incorporated into the human being like physical devices, and the mechanical aspects of movement. With regard to everything else, the more profound our attempts to understand the human being, the less external natural laws apply. My statements will be somewhat aphoristic, of course, because I must keep them brief. It is well known that the human body contains a maximum of slightly more than 10% solid mineral substances and consists primarily of a column of fluid. Within this fluid column, in turn, we find impulses at work that are mediated by the respiratory system or other processes within the human body that in the natural world are found only in freely moving air. Warmth processes then constitute a fourth level. The natural laws we presently believe capable of explaining the entire human being are applicable only to those aspects that resemble the clearly delineated physical mineral substances found in the natural world. Strangely enough, natural laws allow us to understand only one portion of our sensory organization, or, since human sense organs are located primarily in the head, one portion of the human head organization, the makeup of which is the part of the human being that most closely resembles the physical world. The human nervous system radiates outward from the head, at least in part. In any case, it is related to the head organization in the human being. Most people today believe that the entire nervous system is related to what we call human spiritual, mental, and intellectual abilities. If you read a psychology text that has been influenced even slightly by physiology, you will find that it deals only with thinking, especially as it relates to the brain and nervous system, and considers human feelings and will only peripherally. They are tacked on after the fact, as it were. It is generally believed that emotion and will are related to the nervous system in the same way that mental images are. This is not the case. Referring back to the three human systems I described yesterday, I must state that only mental activity as such is directly related to the human nervous system, while emotional activity is indirectly related to the nervous system but directly related to the rhythmic system. This is one of the points where modern science, as a direct result of its admirable progress in other areas, makes it impossible for us to move from understanding human physical organization to understanding our spiritual being. The truth of the matter is that all emotions intervene directly in the human rhythmic system in the broadest sense, as I described it yesterday. The nervous system serves only as a mediator that allows us to have thoughts and ideas about our feelings. Thus, emotional impulses directly affect our breathing and blood circulation. Our nerves are simply the organs that mediate thoughts we may have about our feelings. And just as emotions intervene in the rhythmic system, our will directly influences the system of metabolism and movement. Our nerves relate to the will only to the extent that we have thoughts or mental images about our intentions and actions. Now, you may say that these concepts are of no further interest to physicians, and that they are just a theory that medicine can safely disregard. That is absolutely untrue, however, as becomes apparent as soon as we acknowledge the severe impact on modern medical views of the bias that ascribes all psychological activity to the nervous system. Today, as I am sure you know, we distinguish between so-called sensory nerves, which are said to transmit sensory perceptions and to run from the interior to the sense organs, and so-called motor nerves, which are supposed to have something to do with our will. Although our nerves are indeed anatomically and physiologically metamorphosed in various ways, they are all of the same type. All nerves are only physical transmitters of impressions, and the nerves we now call motor nerves are no different in function from the so-called sensory nerves. Sensory nerves lead to our sense organs so that we can perceive the outer world, while so-called motor nerves, which are nothing more than internal sensory nerves, lead into the interior of the body and transmit our perceptions of moving a limb, for example, or carrying out any internal unconscious movement. Nerves are only transmitters of external or internal perceptions. There are not two types of nerves, sensory and motor nerves. It does not matter to me what we call them, but they are all of the same type and have simply metamorphosed anatomically and physiologically to a certain extent. Only one type of nerve exists. Having spent 35 years working out the details of this view of the human being, I am aware of the obvious objections and have checked them all carefully. If interpreted without bias, every single fact that can be deduced from the way the nervous system does or does not function, let's take tabes dorsalis as an example, is confirmed by the theoretical system I have just explained. Footnote, tabes dorsalis is a syphilitic disorder, also called locomotor ataxia. It affects the dorsal horns of the spinal cord and the sensory nerve trunks. Symptoms include wasting, pain, lack of coordination of reflexes and voluntary movements, and disorders of sensation, nutrition, and vision. End of footnote. In contrast, the modern interpretation of tabes leaves all sorts of unexplained bits and pieces. In spite of how carefully natural science describes such phenomena, they make sense only if you know that there is only one type of nerve, that human feelings are only indirectly, rather than directly, connected with the nervous system, that emotional activity intervenes directly in breathing and circulation, that is, in the human rhythmic system, and that the direct workings of our will are related to metabolism. Internal, unconscious will underlies all metabolic processes, and is then metamorphosed into the conscious will that is the basis of our external conscious movements. Coming to this realization was the first truly shattering result of more than 30 years' work on my view of the human being. Although it is relatively easy to talk about scientific results that deviate only slightly from the norm, it is not at all easy to make headway against the seemingly well-founded bias that two types of nerves exist. So I did not dare to speak of my investigations until 1917, footnote, in his book Riddles of the Soul, Collected Works, Volume 21, end of footnote. I risked making a public statement only after working for more than 30 years to reassure myself that all of the scientific facts were compatible with my view of a single nerve type and did not contradict it. My view of the human being has still another consequence, however. If you accept that emotional impulses directly affect the rhythmic system and will impulses the metabolic motoric system, you realize that the will and its extension into the human emotions, which we can grasp only by spiritual means, by understanding emotions as spiritual entities, constitute the driving force behind circulation, for example. You will have overcome another bias that is truly not easy to overcome. Physiology, which underlies our entire modern school of medical thought, sees the heart as the, in quotes, motor that drives blood circulation. The heart is said to send out the impulses that impel the blood through the organism. In fact, the exact opposite is true. The blood is brought into movement by the organism, by the spiritual human being. In the organs of will, this spiritual human being intervenes directly in metabolism. Similarly, emotional impulses act directly on circulation and respiration, that is, on the human rhythmic system. All inner rhythmical movement originates in the spiritual human being. The heart and its activity is the result, not the cause, of blood circulation and fluid movement. The heart's own movements simply express how it is internally stimulated and moved by motion proceeding from the spiritual human being. Two points will gradually have to provide a new basis for physiology as the foundation of all medicine: the concept of a single nerve type, and the fact that nerve activity relates only to perception and conceptualization, whereas the movement of fluid and gaseous elements in the human being proceed directly from our spiritual aspect, so that the motion of the heart is a consequence of rhythmic movements in the human being, rather than their cause. I once explained my theory of cardiac functioning to a Swedish physician on the train from Trelleborg and Stockholm. I still vividly recall the chaotic and ferocious passions my ideas unleashed in this man, so I understand very well how severely they affect our thought habits. Nonetheless, such views open the door between the physical human being and the spiritual human being. In contrast, assume that two types of nerves exist, with the physical structure of the sensory nerves running from the sense organs toward the center, while the motor nerves proceed from the center outward, serving as material transmitters of the manifestations of human will. This assumption never leaves the material realm. By postulating two types of nerves that actually do not exist, in reality there is only one type, we shut the door on the spiritual aspect of the human being. You see, what science, our admirable science that has served the physical human being so well, has done for the human being as a whole. It has gone so far as to substitute a purely invented theory of two nerve types for the reality of the situation, which is that motor nerves are sensory nerves that simply serve to perceive inner movements. Furthermore, this same science has turned the heart into a kind of pump, a mechanical apparatus that automatically induces rhythmic circulation in the human being. By attributing rhythmic movements within the human being exclusively to the heart as an automatically functioning physical device, science erases the connection between the rhythmic and metabolic systems and the spiritual human being. The door to the spiritual human being has been shut by these two theories: the theory that there are two types of nerves, and the theory that the heart is a physical motor driving blood circulation, whereas in fact its movement is only an expression of the blood moved by the spiritual human being. Shutting the door on the spiritual human being has had significant consequences. Only by seeing how the nervous system is incorporated into the human being, for example, can you make the right connection between that system and the organization of the digestive system. The digestive system is part of the larger human system that I have called the metabolic motoric system, and the nervous system is its polar opposite. Let's look at these two human systems one at a time. With regard to metabolism, substances are taken in from outside. The essential factor in metabolism is the activity induced when outer substances are brought into the body, that is, the activity the human organism must perform as a result of being entered into by a foreign body that must be transformed or metamorphosed. This process is all important in digestion. It reaches a stopping point when the forces of the external substances have been overcome. At this point, the impulse to eliminate sets in. In the metabolic system, waste is eliminated to the outside. We must therefore understand the metabolic motoric organization in this way. First, human will or will-related impulses in the human organism intervene directly in metabolism and overcome the constitution of introduced substances. Then these substances are eliminated to the outside by well-known means. The aspect of digestive activity that runs through all the body's organs and into the organization of the head, that is, into the part of the body where the sensory nervous system is primarily, although not exclusively located, goes beyond its stopping point in the metabolic motoric system. In the organization of the head, the digestive process is taken further in that elimination is internal rather than external. As a result of this internal elimination, the nervous system is deposited inside the human being. The nervous system is the only system in the human being that owes its material content to elimination that remains within the organism rather than being expelled. Although, of course, this elimination remains within the organism only up to a certain point. It is shaped by the sculptural forces of the first invisible and suprasensible member of the human constitution, the so-called etheric body or life body. In addition to the human physical body, we must distinguish this first suprasensible member, the etheric or life body, which exists on a purely dynamic, non-material level. Etheric effects, which are present throughout the universe, take a very specific form in the human being. The etheric body's formative forces include the forces that sculpt products of elimination into the wonderfully structured human brain and nervous system. Ladies and gentlemen, I challenge you to submit any histological, embryological, or evolutionary descriptions of an embryonic cell and a nerve cell, for example, to an unbiased test. Because it is impossible to reconcile all the facts with any theoretical foundation other than the one I have just presented, conscientious skeptics may also be able to relate to other statements based on my spiritual research. This spiritual science states that we can develop an exact form of clairvoyance an exact method of studying supra-sensible factors. I describe this type of research in my book titled How to Know Higher Worlds. Research into supra-sensible worlds leads to the discovery of an artistic, sculptural activity that is present in the natural world but does not obey physical natural laws. In a human being, these sculptural forces are primarily in the head, where they shape matter that would be eliminated from other parts of the body. The strange result of this view is that we discover a number of degenerative activities in our nervous system. The functioning of this system is based entirely on degenerative processes, on elimination that has been taken further than its stopping point in the digestive system, on matter that has been shaped and sculpted in accordance with the elimination process. The fundamental difference between organs belonging to the sensory nervous system and the organs of digestion is that sensory nervous organs have advanced significantly further in their evolution and are involved in a descending evolutionary process, while the organs of the metabolic limb system are still in an ascending phase of evolution, and therefore take the digestive process only to a certain stopping point, after which elimination must set in. These considerations, in addition to revealing the nature of these organs when they are healthy, are also fundamental prerequisites to understanding how these same organs function when diseased. Ultimately, these fundamentals allow us to recognize the true connections between remedies and disease processes. Let me give an example. In the human brain, we might even say in the entire nervous system, matter is developed up to a certain point and then broken down. The depleted breakdown products are then reshaped in our nervous system. Breakdown and elimination, rather than synthesis and assimilation, underlie our conceptual activity. Our mental images depend on a constant atomistic dying process of sorts in our nervous system, a dying process that is constantly counteracted by reconstruction processes. We might say that the moment of death consolidates all the ongoing degenerative processes of the nervous system that are otherwise spread out over an entire earthly lifetime. If we are capable of studying these activities, which involve the workings of material forces up to a certain point, followed by a degenerative process, we may ask ourselves what enables human beings to think. What forces enable us to be spiritual beings? Are they the same as the forces that allow us to enter earthly life through embryonic development? Not at all. Our physical system cannot be permitted to continue its linear development if we are to become human. After a certain point, devolution must set in. Devolution, not evolution, provides the basis for our mental activities. Consider the consequences of the view I just formulated. People generally believe that the nerve process underlying thinking and conceptualizing is an ascending one, like those of growth or nutrition. This is impossible. The basis of conceptualization is a degenerative process. To provide a basis for our thoughts, for the functioning of spirit in us, matter must be destroyed, and the products of destruction sculpturally reshaped. To be able to think, we must first destroy the material basis. We must punch holes in our brain, so to speak. Our ability to think is not based on organic growth forces. For the spirit to be able to move into the human body, our bodily organization must first undergo a process of degeneration, destruction, or partial death. Once you have understood this clearly, you will be able to express it in an image like this. We see a dirt road just after a rain. Cars must have been driving over the road, because it is rutted. But now, let's assume that a being who has never seen cars comes down from Mars. The cars are gone, and the being from Mars sees only the ruts. So it studies the ruts by going underground, and then states that the forces that made the ruts exist below the surface of the Earth, in the Earth's interior, and that they are worked upward from below to make the ruts. We cannot hold it against the being from Mars if it looks for the reason for the ruts in the wrong place, namely in the soil, when in fact the ruts are due to cars driving over the dirt road. Something similar is true of our brain. You may believe that it is shaped and organized from the inside out, but in fact the furrows in the brain are imprinted by soul spiritual activity. At this point, we realize that our sensory nervous system uses physical organs only to offer resistance to the spiritual or mental activities we carry out. We can draw conclusions about a car by tracing its tracks on a wet dirt road, because everything the car did left a trace. Similarly, of course, we can also explain all thinking in terms of traces left in the brain. The materialistic view that explains thinking in terms of the brain is wonderfully deceptive. All thinking and conceptual activity can indeed be explained in terms of the brain, but only because spiritual activity has left its traces there. Having traced this degenerative process in the human being, we can then look for its counterpart among the great workings of the cosmos, in the natural world outside us. In modern human beings, this process is held back in its nascent state, at the moment it comes about. In the natural world, the nascent material breakdown process that underlies the human nervous system is present on the cosmic level wherever silica is found. Silica represents the same process on a cosmic level where it continues, reaching a stopping point only later, instead of being held back in the nascent state as it is in the human head. We need to produce a silica preparation that incorporates the cosmic process in the right way. This remedy, if administered correctly, will relieve an etherically weak human body of an activity it can no longer carry out. Because of the substances we mix with it and the way we prepare it, the silica, if we can get it to the human head, acquires the peculiar ability of relieving the patients of an action that their inner organizational forces are incapable of carrying out because of an organic weakness. This is the correct view of what goes on in the human head. But the head must be seen in connection with spiritual impulses. You must look out into the cosmos at the silica-forming process and recognize that this process, which is held fast in silica or cilicia, constitutes a remedy that temporarily relieves the body of a function it can no longer perform on its own. By reacting to the remedy, the body's internal organization regains the ability to perform that particular function. Thus, spiritual vision reveals the actual function of silica in the human organism when the body cannot carry out a specific function itself. This type of fundamental insight comes about when we understand both the entire human organization and its connection to outer nature. At that point, we simply need to ask what ought to be happening and what is not happening in a particular part of the human organism. If we know where the missing process can be found in the natural world, diagnosis becomes a real basis for treatment. Correctly answering every question that arises in the diagnostic process also directly answers the question of which treatment to provide. Because we understand the specific connection between the human being and the natural world, we can prepare a remedy and predict how it will work. If it does work as we predicted, no empiricism is involved. a true verification has taken place. Look at how the physical sciences generally proceed. When a theory enables scientists to make an accurate prediction, they are not concerned with how many cases verify it. If the right conditions are created, and the prediction comes true in one instance, the initial assumption is considered provisionally verified. Such verification is especially important for practical applications, because in this field, actual practice always confirms whether our predictions were correct. By shifting our focus from the physical to the spiritual aspect of the human being, we learn to predict the therapeutic effects of the processes we observe in the course of diagnosis, just as we would predict a natural process in the chemistry or physics laboratory. If the process we predict occurs, we know our understanding is correct. We apply a broader concept of acceptable scientific procedure, just as the field of physics does. In contrast, the biological sciences accept only empirical methods, especially when practical therapeutic applications are being evaluated. To acquire truly clear and rational insights into the connection between diagnosis and treatment, we need more science rather than less. I am alarmed at how late it has already become. I will therefore shorten the rest of the lecture and simply summarize a few points that will shed light from the therapeutic perspective on what I have already said. If we look at the organization of the sensory nervous system, which is primarily concentrated or localized in the human head, we will find, as I said before, that it supplies the foundations for our thinking and conceptualizing. But what is the human activity we call thinking? It is the reflection of the power of thoughts as such in our consciousness. Because of the way we perceive thinking, we say instinctively and involuntarily that a thought is not a reality. A thought, as we experience it, is powerless and is essentially present only in the form of an image. Thought activity, however, also has another, essentially different aspect. We can call this second aspect to mind quite easily if we simply consider how the conscious manifestation of thinking is still absent in a very small child, while this other aspect, the truly energizing sculptural force of thought activity, is very much present. One aspect of thinking is revealed to ordinary consciousness in the form of mental images, thoughts, and concepts. The second is the force of thoughts that works back into the body. The latter aspect is identical to the sculptural force I mentioned earlier. Therefore, when we look at human mental activity in connection with the entire human organism, we must say that the aspect we perceive and experience directly is like a reflection of a real object. The reality of thought activity lies in its sculptural forces, which are directed inward. These inward-directed sculptural forces are evident in a very small child who has no conscious thought life as yet. In children, these forces work most strongly in shaping the brain, completing the organ that then forms the basis of true conceptual activity. We do not hesitate to speak of latent warmth as opposed to manifest warmth. We know that certain processes release latent warmth, driving it out of the substance that binds it. Although we still hesitate to speak about it, a similar process takes place in children when conscious conceptual activity is consolidated out of the unconscious conceptual activity that is most active in shaping excreted matter to form the nervous system. This sculptural activity, which persists for the duration of a human life but is strongest in childhood, is the first suprasensible element in the human being. Thoughts are suprasensible, but we experience only their reflections. the forces that shape our organs of thought, the forces that work on our nervous system, are also suprasensible. These forces, however, constitute only that portion of the suprasensible human being that is closest to physical events and processes. This portion stands between the physical body and the soul aspect of the human being. If we look at the rhythmic system, which is directly related to human emotional activity, we see that a still higher factor is active there, not merely an etheric sculpting process, but an ensouled etheric force. Essentially, rhythm is the unique interaction of processes that we have seen in the digestive motoric or metabolic motoric system, where material processes are developed to a certain point and then eliminated, and in the nervous system, where eliminated substances are deposited internally. Rhythmic activity begins as a metabolic process, but then excretion comes into play and immediately recedes again. This oscillation between a metabolic process and a neural process of degeneration results in the basic form of any rhythmic activity. The rhythmic activity is related to that of the supersensible or spiritual human being, activity that emerges from an ensouled etheric process. If we look at breathing or blood circulation, or anything else within the scope of rhythmic processes, we see the higher action of an ensouled etheric force as opposed to a simple etheric process. Once again, these rhythmic activities are associated with cosmic processes. We saw that when metabolism exceeds its limits, it is transformed into a nerve process in an inappropriate part of the human being, in an organ where it does not belong. This may sound bizarre, but it corresponds to reality. When metabolic activity stays within the metabolic system itself, but goes beyond the point where elimination is meant to begin, and develops into a misplaced nerve process, various forms of typhoid fever appear. Typhoid illnesses are nerve processes that appear within the metabolic system. Of course, these nerve activities appear only as processes and cannot lead to the actual formation of a nervous system. And now the question is, how do we deal with such a process? In the natural world, we can find antimony ore, a peculiar substance that captures a cosmic process. In fact, all minerals and ores are captured processes. Antimony is a remarkable mineral, a remarkable ore. It immediately attempts to crystallize, putting out spear-shaped or wire-like forms. It looks almost like a mineralized plant or moss. It also has other interesting characteristics. If we subject antimony to a particular electrolytic process and place the resulting substance on a cathode, it requires only a light touch with a metal rod to set off a small explosion. And if we burn antimony under the right conditions and cause the smoke to condense on surfaces of a certain type, the result is a wonderful, in quotes, antimony mirror, deposited by the smoke that forms when antimony ore is subjected to combustion. In a certain sense, burning antimony under the right conditions is an extension of the activity that we see captured in naturally occurring antimony. When we produce an antimony mirror, a very important procedure in our pharmaceutical laboratory, we come very close to forces that counteract the processes fostering nerve formation within the metabolic system. Footnote, see page 19 of this book, end of footnote. The antimonizing forces, as I would like to call them, repulse and confine this metabolic process that is trying to exceed its limits. When we use the antimony from an antimony mirror to repulse this excessive process, the result is a copy of the rhythmic activity. By using the antimonizing force in the right way, it is possible to neutralize or arrest a misplaced nerve-forming process directly, forcing it back into its proper place. We discover the appropriate treatment by looking for a natural process capable of reversing the pathological typhoid conditions. If we clearly understand a pathological condition, we are always able to find an activity in nature that either reinforces or counteracts it, thus establishing a rational method for developing remedies. We sincerely hope that we will be able to carry our search for a remedy for carcinoma through to a successful conclusion. We have already achieved very promising results. I have said that metabolic activity can exceed its limits, metamorphosing into a nerve-forming process in the wrong place. This tendency can also go beyond the point of attempting to form nerves to attempting to develop a sense organism in some inappropriate part of the human body. This tendency is the basis of cancer. Regardless of how much skepticism this view elicits today, applying its guidelines to an histological investigation of carcinomas will prove that the basis of cancer is indeed an attempt to develop a sense organ in the wrong place. Of course, this description is general and approximate. Nonetheless, the activity that underlies the development of cancer should actually occur only in the development of sense organs. Now the question is, how can we make this process regress to the point where metabolism should actually stop and lead directly to elimination rather than to deposition? In this case, the opportunity for healing presents itself when we use the juices of the various subspecies of Viscum album. This opportunity is based not on a superficial idea, as many people have objected, but on a true understanding of what happens when the parasitic mistletoe plant grows on various tree species. Footnote: mistletoe is the common name for Loranthaceae, a family of chiefly tropical parasitic herbs and shrubs with leathery leaves and waxy white berries. Mistletoes, aerial hemiparasites with green leaves that carry out photosynthesis, attach themselves to their hosts by modified roots called haustoria. The mistletoe, commonly sold in the U.S., is Phoradendron flavescens. Most popular in Europe is the true mistletoe, Viscum album. End of footnote. The underlying process is extremely complicated. From the cosmic perspective, the process of wood formation, which turns an ordinary herbaceous, non-woody plant into a tree, is unique. An ordinary herbaceous plant that will not develop into a tree is intimately related to the soil with which its roots are so finely intertwined. These roots are actually still part of the soil, because a constant exchange of substances takes place between soil and roots. Up above, an herbaceous plant develops first leaves and then flowers as it is exposed to atmospheric influences. I must now mention an issue that derives from a biological geology of sorts. Today, we see the inorganic component of the soil as an entity in its own right. Originally, however, the mineral component of the soil was an excretion. Modern geology fails to understand the process of soil formation because it isolates the purely mineral foundation of soil and considers it separately. Seeing geology as a complete system in and of itself is like claiming that the skeleton of a human being is capable of independent existence. A human skeleton exists only as a mineralized excretion. It cannot develop by itself. It cannot be considered in isolation, but only in connection with the entire human being. Similarly, geology can be seen only in connection with a living organic earth, pervaded with spiritual beings. Geological formations are excretions. They did not come about by themselves. Anthracite formation, for example, is only the simplest, most elementary process of mineralization. All geological formations, from slate to crystals, are excretions that have mineralized out of a formerly undifferentiated organic and spiritual element. It is very difficult to present these issues today because the reasons against them are so obvious and readily understandable as to be almost matters of course. It is really very easy today to calculate, or approximate at least, no claims to precision, how many millions or hundreds of millions of years ago a particular geological formation was laid down. This method appears very exact, but it is similar to the method I use when I observe the little changes in my heart that take place during a month, and then attempt to calculate what change will have occurred in 3 years. It's exactly the same thing. I can calculate the condition of my heart 300 years into the future, or 300 years into the past, regardless of the fact that I myself will not be, or was not, alive at that time. The calculation is correct, and the conclusion incontrovertibly logical, but neither one corresponds to reality. Similarly, geological calculations, though they are incontrovertibly logical, do not correspond to reality, because Earth did not exist millions of years ago. The Earth did not exist then any more than I existed 300 years ago, in the physical human form suggested by my calculations. At this point, therefore, a higher method of observation is required, a view that sees all minerals as deposited excretions. When plants emerge from soil, the soil is the mineral component. When a tree develops instead of an ordinary herbaceous plant, its lignified trunk is a throwback, an atavistic recurrence of an earlier state that encompassed the entire earth. Just as we ourselves have atavistic organs, the development of a tree is a throwback to an earlier condition of the earth. When viscum grows on a tree, it grows under earlier earthly conditions, in a medium that is not soil, because soil was a later development, the result of separation or excretion. If we pursue the matter further, we also discover that the sense organs were the last human organs to evolve. In contrast, if we trace viscum's development, we find that it belongs to a very early period in the evolution of the earth. If we incorporate the viscum process into the human organism, especially if we inject it directly into the circulation, we send the human body back to an early stage of its evolution on earth, counteracting the most recent processes. It must be quite clear, however, that these ideas are initially only abstract thought constructs, or at best, abstract clairvoyant constructs. They are insights of a sort, but not yet a complete overview. If we take the activity of mistletoe and introduce it directly into the human body, it changes too much, as I also said yesterday in a similar example. Therefore, we are now experimenting with a manufacturing method that submits the active principle in mistletoe to the centrifugal or radial forces that develop at very high speeds. It is not easy to construct the very complicated machine required for this method, but we can now transform mistletoe activity into a totally different aggregate process that allows us to use a much greater concentration of the mistletoe-forming tendency than occurs naturally, since the mistletoe process today is a decadent one. We will continue to attempt to improve this anti-carcinoma remedy, which has already been developed to a certain level of efficacy and has produced promising results. The remedy will be completely ready and available for testing only when we have finished subjecting it to the laboratory technique involving the centrifuge that has just been built. We will apply this technique in seeking ever better ways of dealing with cancer. We are using other remedies in similar ways to come to grips with tuberculosis, pathological processes in different organs, and so on. It is much too late now to go into detail, but I do want to explain the principles involved. As I said earlier, we administer our remedies in different ways, by introducing them directly into the metabolic system, by injecting them into the circulatory system where they work differently, or by adding them to baths and the like, so that they act on the sensory process from outside. We also use what we call curative eurythmy, in which the patient performs movements intrinsic to the human body itself. Unbiased observation of the human hand makes it impossible to say that a hand can exist without moving, since the actual form of the hand is simply movement held fast. A hand is inseparable from motion, as is every other human limb. Carrying out individual movements that correspond to the form qualities of a limb or organ can reflect back on these form qualities with a healing effect. This is the principle underlying curative eurythmy, which is related to the artistic eurythmy that will be performed tomorrow at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art. During the physiological aspects, developing the physiological aspects of eurythmy leads to curative eurythmy, and curative eurythmy, in turn, leads to the externally administered therapies used in the Clinical Therapeutic Institute in Arnhem. Thus, in this Clinical Therapeutic Institute, which, as I mentioned yesterday, is under the excellent leadership of Dr. Ita Wegman, who is also present here, we attempt to develop treatments rationally, not only on the basis of modern natural scientific knowledge of the physical human being, but also on the basis of what can be known about the spiritual human being. For this purpose, the Clinical Therapeutic Institute in Arnhem had to be associated with a clinical pharmaceutical laboratory capable of producing medicines in a way that corresponds to a true understanding of the human being. In these few brief and aphoristic remarks, I have done my best to point out that our intention is not to oppose modern science, medicine, but to elaborate upon it through investigations that are as scientific as any work in contemporary medicine, and yet explore areas of the human organism in which spiritual factors play a role. An holistic school of medical thought must also encompass irregularities or types of disease that result from inappropriate or misplaced intervention on the part of unconscious spiritual forces. In addition, medicine must cease to see the human being simply as a physical entity and the routine functions of the human body as merely physical processes. Purely physical processes do indeed predominate in part of the human body, but the element provided by the spiritual world enters most of the human organism directly, just as we receive our material component directly from the physical material world in the form of food, and so on. An holistic physiology is needed for holistic diagnosis, and holistic diagnosis goes hand in hand with real treatment that is inseparable from diagnosis. Once we recognize the relationship between human beings and their cosmic surroundings, we can derive remedies from these surroundings, not merely through empirical experimentation, but through a clear understanding of the connection between the human being and the cosmos. Thus we create treatments that will not tolerate being separated from diagnosis. Treatment and diagnosis together form a whole. The attempts I have spoken about tonight are meant to be fostered in the medical section within our spiritual scientific movement, and reflect the longings of many anthroposophical physicians. I hope my brief indications were not too unclear. When such issues must be presented very succinctly, the emphasis naturally falls on the broadest principles. Unfortunately, the details sometimes suffer. I hope, however, that I have at least been able to provide you with food for thought. The end of Lecture 3.